Welcome to the Daily Dive Weekend Edition. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and every week I explore the top stories making waves in the news and some that are just plain interesting. I'll connect you with the journalists and the people who know the story and bring you news without the noise so you can make an informed decision. You can catch a new episode of the Daily Dive every Monday through Friday, and it's ready when you wake up. On the Weekend Edition, I'll be bringing you some of the best stories from the week. One of the big questions still left unanswered, how did the coronavirus infiltrate the White House? Many experts say that the reliance on coronavirus rapid response tests without other mitigation strategies like wearing masks and social distancing might have been the problem. For more on this story, we'll speak to Sarah Toy, health and science reporter at the Wall Street Journal.
So we know that the White House used the Abbott Laboratories ID Now rapid test that day. Once guests got a negative test, they were taken to the Rose Garden where a lot of people weren't wearing masks. So basically, they used it as a one-time screener. But public health experts I spoke to say that that really isn't how it's meant to be used. Regardless of the type of test, whether you're talking about this rapid test or a lab-based test, any strategy that relies solely on testing is going to have holes in it because no test is perfect.
One of the public health experts that you spoke to had a very good analogy. They said they were using it like a metal detector, screening just at the front door. And once you got your results, boom, you were in. And as you mentioned, that's not really the way it works. It needs to be in conjunction with all of that other stuff. And these rapid response tests, especially, they can produce some false negatives at a higher rate than the lab tests.
Yes, you're right. You know, these kinds of tests trade speed in for accuracy. Like I said, they're not meant to be one-time screeners. And, you know, some studies have shown that this Abbott ID Now test has around a 91% sensitivity, which means it can miss about 9% of infected cases. And one of the experts I spoke to, Ashish Jha at Brown University, made this really good comparison that was like having a metal detector that missed 10% of weapons. And, you know, you'd never allow that if you were protecting the president.
Have you gotten any response back from Abbott Laboratories as far as their testing product or even with regards to this case that happened at the Rose Garden?
So we did reach out to Abbott to see what they had to say, and they basically said no test detects the virus immediately after the person becomes infected. They said the goal should be to test often, if that's not possible, to test if you've been exposed or have symptoms. And, you know, they actually brought up a really good point. Dr. Jha actually, and many other healthcare and public health experts have been advocating for something called surveillance testing, where you test the population a few times a week using these rapid tests. But since they do have a higher rate of false negatives, you know, the idea here is that if the test misses the virus on one day, it'll be more likely to catch it on another day. So it's actually very important in controlling the spread of COVID-19. We're not trying to say that rapid tests are bad. When used correctly, they're great.
You know, we keep going back to this Rose Garden as being this possible super spreader event, only because so many people have come down with positive test results for COVID-19 that attended this, people that were in the president's close circle. And these super spreader events are worrisome because they lead to other infections down the road. Other White House journalists have gotten this. Trump's body man, his campaign manager, the press secretary has gotten all of this stuff. You had a very specific example in your article about the Notre Dame president, Reverend Jenkins, and his experience when he arrived at the White House for that event. Can you tell us that story?
So Reverend Jenkins, when he arrived at the White House that day, he was taken to a room where he was tested using a nasal swab. Then he was taken to another room with a few other people to await results. Everyone in that room was wearing a mask. But when his test came back negative, he was taken to the Rose Garden and told he no longer had to wear a mask. You know, on Fridays, the school then said he tested positive for the virus. And that kind of highlights the need for this sort of layered approach when it comes to COVID-19 prevention. These tests aren't perfect. You really need more than just the tests. You need masks. You need social distancing. You need to not pack people together in one space. But that's not what the White House did on September 26th. They used a test to screen people one time for this event. And, you know, multiple public health experts we spoke to said that was just inappropriate.
Sarah Toy, health and science reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Another big story as we continue to develop these vaccines, the FDA has put out guidelines on the protocols to follow before a vaccine can get emergency use authorization.
They want an expert panel to review any vaccine candidate and also want 2 months of safety data. This will most definitely put any vaccine out of reach before the election. For more on this story, we'll speak to Angelica Levito, health reporter at Bloomberg News.
The FDA has signaled that it will use its emergency use authorization powers, which basically means that while it won't approve a vaccine, it will allow it to be used in this emergency use. Obviously, we're in a pandemic, so the regulations are a little bit different there. But in order to do that, what they're saying is they want to see 2 months following the end of the trial to see how everybody's doing before they make a decision. And that's important because we're hearing that even if we get some of the initial results in October, obviously then you have to wait another few months, which could really push back the timeline faster than what some of the federal officials have been promising.
We have 4 vaccine candidates right now in late stage trials. We have Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, obviously all in kind of different stages. I think AstraZeneca's trial is still on hold right now. So really, who are we looking at to have something done, at the earliest possible?
Correct. So AstraZeneca's trial is still on hold. We're expecting results from Pfizer and Moderna sometime this fall.
And that's the first reporting, though, right? After that, we would still need 2 months of data after that. I'm just trying to get the timetable down right.
Yeah, and so that's what the FDA is signaling they want is 2 months of data. That will give them time to make sure that none of the trial participants are having any adverse effects. And that way they can review all of the data, including how people did during the trial and then after the trial.
How does the White House figure into all of this? Because we're hearing that, you know, the White House is objecting to some of the FDA's vaccine standards. Do they have the power to do that?
So it had been reported that the White House was opposed to some of these guidelines because ultimately they will slow down the time frame. However, the FDA went ahead today and published them, signaling that the FDA is going forward with them and that it's ready to move forward.
Angelica, talk to me a little bit about public trust in vaccines, because that's so important right now. We're already getting a lot of polls that are saying people don't want to even take the first generation vaccine. So even as fast as these companies can push out these vaccines, a lot of people are saying, well, I kind of want to wait till the second round, or a bunch of people have taken it and I see that it's safe. So rushing all of this stuff, it doesn't really seem like it's going to do anything one way or the other.
And that's the purpose of FDA saying we want 2 months of data once the trial is complete. And then also they're convening this advisory committee. And it's pretty typical whenever there is a vaccine candidate or FDA has this advisory meeting for all kinds of different approvals that it goes through. But there was concern that maybe they wouldn't enlist their committee here and sort of move quickly. But now what happens is that in order for the committee to meet, all of the materials that they're reviewing, the data, everything must be made public. That will ideally give the public a window into what the safety data looks like. And then, of course, the recommendation from these outside experts who have no connection to the FDA, they're really independent, and their job is to give their unbiased advice to the FDA. So that should hopefully help people as they make their determinations. But of course, it's really up to the FDA to say, here's what we know and here's what we don't know.
We're hearing a lot from the White House, obviously. We're hearing from the FDA now. What are we hearing from the drug companies themselves that are making these vaccine candidates? As you mentioned, Pfizer and Moderna might be kind of first on the block to have their data ready and available. How are they figuring into this whole discussion?
They're all saying that they'll abide by the regulations that the FDA sets out and that they are committed to following all the rules. And of course, earlier this fall, they had published that letter saying that they're committed to the science and promised they will not rush a vaccine. So they say that they're ready to commit to all of those guidelines.
Angelica Levito, health reporter at Bloomberg News. Thank you very much for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris had their first and only debate on Wednesday. And while it wasn't as chaotic as the Trump-Biden debate, there were a few moments that stood out. The smile from Senator Harris when Pence was trying to talk over her, and the real star of the show, the fly that stood on Pence's head for 2 minutes. There was lots of coronavirus talk and plenty of Dodge questions. For more on this, we'll speak to Sabrina Siddiqui, national political reporter at The Wall Street Journal.
It was certainly less chaotic than the presidential debate between President Trump and Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. There was some interrupting. You had the tense moment a number of times where Senator Harris turned to Vice President Pence and said, "I'm speaking. I'm speaking." It was her way of telling him to stop interrupting her and that she wouldn't stand for interruption. But by and large, this was a debate where all that each candidate had to do was try and not make the person at the top of the ticket look worse, and to try and sort of maintain, at least for Kamala Harris, a status quo, for Mike Pence to try and perhaps defend a president who is struggling in both national and battleground state polls. So I think coming out of that debate, nothing really fundamentally shifted those dynamics. Biden is still leading Trump, and there is not much that Mike Pence was able to do, even if he presented a more empathetic tone or tried to really change the trajectory of the race, because ultimately people don't vote for the vice president. They vote for the person who's at the top of the ticket.
Yeah, Mike Pence definitely had the heavier lift last night after the first debate from President Trump and Joe Biden. But real quick, before we move on to some of the big moments, just something on the optics of what was happening. As you mentioned, Senator Kamala Harris constantly saying, "Hey, you know, I'm speaking. It's my turn right now." The smile that she had, you know, when she was looking at him when he was going over time and had his remarks. And then on the other side, it was blowing up on Twitter, Mike Pence's red eye, and then the fly that was standing on his head for 2 minutes kind of took a lot of the breath out of it. And a lot of people had fun with it on Twitter.
Absolutely. And I think the way a lot of people saw the debate could really be captured by the fascination with the fly. The most notable thing to come out of the debate was a relentless focus on the fact that a fly was sitting on Mike Pence's head for 2 minutes. But I do think, as you said, the heavier lift was really for Mike Pence. And optics aside, this debate also was coming at a time when the president and a growing number of staffers at the White House have tested positive for the coronavirus. So there was a lot riding, I think, on Mike Pence. And so as we get more into the moments that mattered, I think that was really fundamentally what the debate was going to be about, even if there is this commentary about facial expression and the infamous fly now seen around the world.
Let's start off there on the big moments from the debate. Coronavirus obviously was going to be central. It's what they started off with. There was some dodging definitely by Mike Pence when it came to being asked about the U.S. death toll as a percentage of the population, how it's higher than almost every other wealthy nation in the world. So definitely a lot of defense for Mike Pence, but it looked like they were living in two different worlds the way they were describing the handling of the pandemic.
They absolutely were. And I think that for the Biden campaign, the coronavirus pandemic and the president's handling of it has really been at the center of his message for 5 months now, going into month six. And so it was quite clear that Mike Pence was prepared for that, knowing that that would really be at the core of what Senator Harris would attack the Trump administration on. But when he responded, I think he was sort of painting a picture that is not in line with what most of the American public is feeling at home. You know, they've tried to sound these positive notes about how the country is actually not doing that bad, how they've done everything they possibly could, how he said President Trump has put the health of Americans first. If you look at a lot of the mixed messaging the administration has sent about basic public health guidelines, like wearing a mask, social distancing, you know, the president, before he contracted coronavirus, was still holding both indoor and outdoor large-scale rallies without any distancing in place. Even after he's contracted the virus, people are walking around the White House despite the outbreak. They're not wearing masks. That was the reality that Mike Pence had to counter. And it's just not clear that he was able to do it, in part because in order to do so, he would have to take a different position than President Trump. And so he really was defending, despite being the head of the coronavirus task force, what the president's position on coronavirus has been, despite the fact that it has not been in line with public health experts or what a lot of Americans have been experiencing at home.
Yeah, I think Kamala Harris missed a moment when she could have pressed Pence a little bit more on the president saying, "Hey, don't let coronavirus run your life. Don't be scared of it." She could have pressed a little bit more there. But I thought Mike Pence had a strong attack when he was asking her about the vaccine, or when Senator Harris was talking about the vaccine, saying, when the scientists say it's ready to go, I'm going to do it. When President Trump says it's ready to go, if he tells me to take it, I'm not going to do it. And he said, you know, stop playing politics with people's lives. Stop undermining a vaccine. I thought that that was a strong moment, because it is a tough balance for the Biden campaign to walk, at least when it comes to vaccines and the safety of the whole thing.
This has been a balancing act for the Biden campaign, in part because it was Senator Harris who first said she would not take a vaccine before the election if Trump were to announce one. Right. And that kind of kicked off this focus on whether or not the Biden campaign was trying to undermine public confidence in a vaccine at a time when polling already is showing that there is not a great deal of trust in a coronavirus vaccine. So that put her in the position of having to separate President Trump from public health officials like Dr. Anthony Fauci, who have not given any indication that if there is a vaccine in the next few months, the public should not trust it. And so that was a place where she had to be more clear in saying, if health officials greenlight the vaccine, then it's fine. And maybe try to distinguish between simply President Trump announcing that there was a vaccine and that it was safe to take. You know, another piece that you pointed out is, you know, how far did she go in pointing out that there is this outbreak at the White House, that the coronavirus is once again front and center with just less than a month to go until the election? It seemed like there was a tactical decision on the part of the Biden campaign not to go after the president's diagnosis or the growing number of cases at the White House. But there are a lot of people, I think, certainly Democratic operatives I've spoken to, who believe that it actually would have been within bounds and perhaps as clear a reminder as any that the people who are in charge of leading the country out of this pandemic have actually been affected directly by the virus because of a lot of the ways in which they've played fast and loose with the public health guidelines.
Another area where I thought it was strong for Senator Harris was when they were talking about health care and, you know, them trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. She said, hey, they're coming for you if you have a pre-existing condition, heart disease, diabetes, breast cancer. I thought that was a strong moment, because on the Republican side, they really didn't have a plan. We went through repeal and replace. They didn't have a plan then, and they dropped the issues. They don't, you know, there was no plan after that. And then just briefly on that front, too, another missed opportunity for Senator Harris was talking about packing the court. Joe Biden was asked about it. They knew she was going to be asked about it. I think they need to come up with an answer for that.
That is, I think it was probably one of the lines that Pence gained a lot of traction from, which is where he said, I just want the record to show that she didn't answer the question, when he tried to pivot from healthcare to this idea of packing the court, adding seats to the Supreme Court, where, yes, he was trying to deflect from the conversation around healthcare and pre-existing conditions. But it's not just President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence who are talking about reforming the Supreme Court or expanding the Supreme Court. It's actually a very popular movement within the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And so it's not clear how sustainable it is for Senator Harris or Vice President Biden to continue and dismiss it as a distraction. But I think the calculation they're making is that both sides are very energized by this Supreme Court vacancy left by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And so issues of court packing really only resonate with the base of each party, who already, based on most surveys, are poised to turn out in very large numbers. And their interest, at least, is to keep the focus on the coronavirus pandemic, which is what they think this election will fundamentally be about. So I think in the coming weeks, we'll see if that calculation is true. If court packing is more of a Washington issue, or something that voters are actually concerned about when they go and cast their ballots.
Sabrina Siddiqui, national political reporter at The Wall Street Journal and political analyst at CNN. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Don't forget to join us on social media, at Daily Dive Pod on Twitter and Daily Dive Podcast on Facebook. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow us on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcast. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and this is the Daily Dive Weekend Edition.